General Electric in America had a big machinery breakdown a little while back. It brought everything grinding to a halt, and people tried to mend it and couldn't get anywhere. And after a bit, they called in a retired mechanic, a man called Charles Steinmetz, and asked him if he could see what the problem was. And he kind of wandered round a little bit, prodded and poked, and finally, he just put his hand in his pocket, took out a piece of chalk, marked a cross on the side of the machinery and said, "You'll find the faults in there." They took the thing apart, and to their astonishment, they found the fault was exactly where he said it was. And it was all mended, everything started up again, everything was fine. A few days later, Steinmetz sent in a bill to General Electric for $10,000. I mean, he'd saved them a fortune, but they thought it was a little bit steep just for a few minutes and, a bit of chalk. And they asked him to itemize it, so he sent it back itemized, making one chalk mark, $1. Knowing where to put it, $9,999. You kind of feel Jesus could charge loads more, actually. He has an uncanny knack of knowing just where to put the chalk mark. And it's like that really in this story. Jesus is speaking about self-righteous people who look down on others, and we don't like those types, and neither does Jesus, we discover. You know, the person who thinks, "I've made it, I've arrived," if you get those thoughts filling your head too much, it's very hard not to become smug and snooty. And the religious version, "I've made it, I've arrived with God," that's worst of all because you kind of can't climb any higher. Now, when I talk about self-righteous people, I imagine most of us are thinking about them as we try and think of examples, people out there. But the truth is that pretty nearly all of us spend much of our life looking for, longing for approval from others, wondering if we've been accepted or are acceptable. Tim Keller, the American pastor, tells a story of a time he's on a plane with a Japanese friend. And as they were talking, he said to him, "Are there a lot of poor Japanese in Japan?" He was trying to work out how the society worked and held together. And his friend says, "There are a lot of homeless Japanese in Tokyo, and it's pretty interesting." And Tim says, "Oh, really? Tell me." And he says, "Well, it's like this in Japan. If you lose your job, you don't come home and tell people because you're ashamed. Not only that, your family doesn't want to know because it's too shameful. So what you do every day when you lose your job is you come home, you don't tell anybody, and every day you put on your suit and you leave and you hang out with other people who don't have a job." And he says, "After a while, if you can't get another job, you just don't come back. You don't tell people. You just don't come back." And Tim said, "Why?" And he says, "Well, it's an Asian thing. You wouldn't understand the shame." Well, I understand a bit about it being an Asian thing. I don't think it's exclusively an Asian thing. I can remember meeting people in the city 25 years ago who were wearing suits and coming up to the city every day and didn't have a job. They just hadn't yet found the courage to tell anyone at home. But in every culture, in every century, there's a hunger for approval and a hunger for acceptance. And tonight, we're looking at the religious version of that hunger to be accepted. And, you know, there are sort of indicators that go around any religious grouping. When you see who's in and who's out in a religion, it tells you plenty about what their God is like. And it's bad enough to face the shame of those who feel they're out with God. You know, they don't belong, they're not accepted. It's actually terrible to meet those who regard themselves as in, because they think they are acceptable. And those are the people Jesus is speaking of here. Pick it up at verse 9. "To some who were confident of their own righteousness and looked down on everyone else, Jesus told this parable." It's a story that revolves around two characters, two stereotypes to the point he's making. Verse 10, "Two men went up to the temple to pray, one a Pharisee, the other a tax collector." Now, as you know, Pharisees were very religious types. They weren't clergy, they were laymen, but in the God culture of the day, they were very influential and powerful group. They were looked up to as the sort of ethical models for others. They thought of themselves as the guardians of the moral flame. Hard to think of a contemporary that fits everything about a Pharisee, but for the guardian of the moral flame, what about the social media troll? You know, the master, the mistress of the vindictive holier-than-thou tweet. And the tax collectors, well, they were the kind of polar opposite. Traitors, collaborators with the occupying forces, extortioners. They made their money by raising over and above the amount they had to hand in. So they just squeeze as much out of you as they think they can get. Yeah, they were powerful financial sharks and swindlers. Today's equivalent? Well, again, it's hard to get all the points right, aren't they? But, the predictable one would be the investment banker, wouldn't it? And if you are a banker and you're rolling your eyes already and thinking what a cliche and not all bankers cut corners and so on, someone's got to do the job, you've got it precisely. That's how tax collectors would have felt. That's why Jesus chose one for this story. And the story is full of surprises. Here's the first of them. The insider who found himself out. Actually, of course, it's not much of a surprise for us. You don't need to be any kind of expert. You just need to pick up any of the Gospels and start reading them, and you find the Pharisees are always getting it wrong. You know, the Pharisee gets it wrong, surprise. No, that's a bit like, reading an Agatha Christie novel when you know who did it. There's not much surprise left. In a binary world of goodies and baddies, we're used to the Pharisee always being the baddie. And as soon as we hear there's a Pharisee, we know the end of the story. He has to be out. But as soon as Jesus' listeners heard there was a Pharisee, they thought they knew the end of the story. He had to be in. We get so glib and dismissive of them. I want to have a kind of PR firm to reinstate the Pharisee, restore their reputation and our respect for them. You see, I want to start a Save the Pharisee Club. Well, just look at them for a moment and put your prejudices aside for a second. See, verse 11, the Pharisee prayed, "God, I thank you, I'm not like other people." And there's no reason to doubt him. See, I'm not like other people, robbers, literally snatchers away. It happens every day, doesn't it? Do you know, it was only a couple of months or so back here, there were an elderly couple just visiting us for the evening. No, for the day, actually. And she had her handbag stolen from under her chair. You can understand, couldn't you, if as they went home, they thought, I wish there were more Pharisees at All Souls. Well, you know, I'm talking to a friend the other day. He's had his wallet snatched from his pocket. Well, who would he like to have around? Yeah, any government, any chief constable looking at crime statistics is muttering to themselves, if only there were more Pharisees. God, I thank you, I'm not like other people, robbers, evildoers. Literally, the word has got the sense of using power corruptly and embezzling. Yeah, one look at the tax collector and you can understand why he mentions this. But you don't have to look far around the world at any time, do you, to see the damage they cause from money laundering to tax evasion. Yeah, they do it on the macro scale, they do it on the micro. Now, if Martin Mills, our church warden, was here tonight, he's a tax inspector as a day job. Purely professionally, he would wish there were more Pharisees around. Robbers, evildoers, adulterers. I read a 41-year-old's testimony once, and she wrote this: "At my age, it would be naive to suppose I'd not had at least one affair with a married man. You know, all the statistics suggest the normality of adultery is on the increase, and it invades every level of society, from the royal family to the most socially deprived. Yet even in our sexually permissive society, the insults the media aim at adulterers, you know, love rat, homebreaker, they speak of the hurts and the agonies and deceits that would be spared if sexual fidelity was the norm. Pharisees, every marriage needs them. And not just marriage, of course. Church as well. Look how he goes on, verse 12. I fast twice a week. The law said you had to do it once a year. He says, I'm doing it twice a week. Only thought of writing up the book on the 2-5 diet. I mean, he'd have made a fortune. Who takes their religion that seriously? I give a tenth of all I get. Again, the law spoke of this tithing, this giving of a tenth, and named certain crops that should be tithed. The Pharisee did it right down to garden herbs, determined God would not miss out on anything. A tenth of all I get. Imagine the look on the treasurer's face. If every time the basket came down the row, people were putting in a tenth of their weekly income. Now, don't talk to treasurers. They'll be saying, Pharisees, every church needs them. Now, what I'm really asking for is that we face the verdict on the Pharisee, not in the light of some nominal lip service only religion, but as a man whose religion had so gripped him, it affected his eating habits, his sex life, his wallet. He's so much more impressive than we often give Pharisees credit for. But in spite of all that, he was out. Look at verse 14. I tell you, this man, the tax collector, rather than the Pharisee, went home justified before God. The Pharisee is not acceptable. And we don't have to look too far to understand. You notice how he began praying in verse 11? I thank you that I'm not like other people. Yeah, he was playing the comparison game. And we can all look good that way if we choose the right person to compare ourselves with. Now, don't start looking around the room. Someone will be looking back at you. And you see where it leaves this Pharisee. He actually has a very thin view of righteousness. You know, a brief list of negative virtues, a small handful of I would never do that's. Not a trace of love or mercy or compassion. His goodness doesn't go that deep. He speaks as if for God, love was only as deep as no adultery. Justice only went as far as no corruption. Integrity only as rich as no robbery. And actually, it becomes a very self-centered life. He prays, and God is his first word. And that's God's last appearance in the prayer. Notice his prayer's nothing to do with anything God might do or he might long that God did do. It just points to himself and who he is and what he's done. I thank you that I am not like others. I fast twice a week. I give a tenth of all I get. His prayer is so full of self-congratulation, someone wrote, it hardly gets off the ground, let alone wings itself to heaven. And you notice when he prayed, verse 11, the Pharisee stood by himself and prayed. You do that when you're better than others. You separate. You look down on, you keep your distance, you show you're in a different league from. Actually, the more you think about it, it's a great relief that God can't stand Pharisees. Until we realize how easily we become Pharisees. How easily we compare. How we can distance ourselves mentally from others. And we should know better. We're not a patch on this Pharisee, and he got nowhere. He's out. The insider. Who found himself out. Here's the second surprise. The outsider who found himself in. The spotlight switches to the tax collector in verse 13. But the tax collector stood at a distance. You sense he's uncomfortable in the temple, doesn't really know his way around. Just as some of you may be uncomfortable in church, you know. You may look around and assume you're not in the same league spiritually as those around here. You know, they kind of look respectable and acceptable spiritually to you. And, you know, we may be here and there may be smiles around us, but we don't really know where to begin. And this man didn't. He wouldn't even look up to heaven, but beat his breast, head down, shuffling his feet, beating his breast as if he knows his heart is his problem. And he said, "God, have mercy on me, a sinner." Which is not a long prayer, is it? Not sure he had the vocabulary for a long prayer. "Have mercy on me, a sinner." Literally, he actually prayed, "Have mercy on me, the sinner." As if he saw himself as much below the rest of humanity as the Pharisee imagined himself above them. You know, he feels in a class of his own. And no hiding, no excusing, is the "have mercy on me, the sinner." Now, for some of us who really think we can't call ourselves the sinner, you know, when it comes to the big ones, the major ones, as you think of them, you know, robbery, murder, adultery, I mean, they're not on our list. And because we're not the sinner, we actually sometimes find it very hard to say we're a sinner, not with any seriousness. I can remember, and just after I was kind of out of the egg, beginning the Christian life, I'd gone on a house party to help some teenagers, and a little while after it, someone said to me afterwards, he said, "Oh, I remember seeing you when you came there then. I thought how arrogant you were." And no one likes to be called arrogant, and I'm no exception. And I can remember bristling at it, and I discovered he'd made his judgment watching me play football. It's not that I'd done any flash stuff. I'm not good enough to do any of that. It was really just my competitiveness. And I knew he was very competitive as well. But he'd spotted my attitude that really I was playing in goal, you know, and really I wasn't going to give any of the youngsters a chance. I was just going to save anything they could shoot at me. And it just started me thinking. And I realized I didn't have to do any of the big ones. Just with 1,001 little selfishnesses and deceits and positionings and put-downs, I could lead a life that had me center stage all the time. God, have mercy on me, a sinner. Have mercy. And he doesn't even use the usual word for mercy here. It's a word that means make atonement for. Let your anger be removed from me. See, he knows what he deserves, and it's not mercy. He's not doing one of those prayers where you've actually kind of blown it, and you may even have blown it big time, and you're saying, "Yeah, I'm sorry, I've got that absolutely wrong, but P.S., I am a pretty good bloke, really. That was just a blip." He knows that's not him. Here's a prayer of true dependence and real desperation. His only hope is for God to have mercy. God, have mercy on me, a sinner. See, it is very personal, isn't it? And he's in. He's in. Verse 14. I tell you, this man, rather than the other, went home justified before God, went home right with God, not self-righteous. It's mercy, not merit. It's about what God has done, not what he has done. The Pharisee gives 6 reasons why God ought to act for him. The tax collector, 1 reason why God must act for him. He's a sinner. He's the sinner. He can't pull it off himself. But he found what to do with his sin. Remember Pesh saying the decision in front of him? Does he face God as a sinner looking for a redeemer? The tax collector found the redeemer, just like Pesh did. A tale of surprises. The insider who found himself out, the outsider who found himself in. So which is your surprise? I tell you, Jesus says. He's the one in the end who's going to spring the surprise and deliver the verdict. And will it be the ugly surprise? You've acted as if you're in and suddenly discovered you're out. Or the pleasant one, you've always thought of yourself as an outsider, and suddenly you've discovered you could be in. Both of them went home. One right with God, the other not. Yeah, we will all go home tonight. Some right with God, some maybe not. And as he ends the story, Jesus makes it clear its relevance isn't just for the two characters. You see how it ends at the end of verse 14? For all those who exalt themselves will be humbled, and those who humble themselves will be exalted. The story isn't saying, wouldn't it be nice if God were like that? It's saying he is. And it's not a mere story. It's not promises, promises. The next chapter begins with the story of Zacchaeus, a real live tax collector with an awful CV. And discovers he's accepted. The Jesus who tells the story is heading to Jerusalem. He's heading to the cross. He's heading to the place where mercy can be found by any and all of us. That atonement word for mercy, it was a word used in the temple of a mercy seat inside the Holy of Holies, the space that represented God's holy presence, a space in which only the high priest, only once a year, only after a sacrifice was made and placed there, could possibly enter. And Jesus will become not the once a year, but the once for all. Once for all time, once for all who will come to him, sacrifice that can make atonement for the sinner. Have mercy on me, a sinner. He will. We have Jesus' word for it. We have Jesus' death for it. Look, I know I've told this story a while back, but I remember once getting to know a banker in the city, a man called John. He'd started to look into the Christian faith, and he got questions. I went around to meet him in his office after work one day, and he had a sort of glass office, and there was a kind of whole floor of traders in front of him, only it was empty when I got round there, apart from him, myself, and the cleaner. And as we were talking, he was one of those sort of dramatic black and white people. And we were talking about the Christian message and God and Jesus. And he said to me, look, Hugh, you've got to realize I'm an evil man. And I had a story like this in mind. And I said to him, that's all right, John. My God specializes in evil men. And as we talked a little more about God's mercy, he said, what do I have to do? Well, I said, you have to turn to him and pray a prayer like this. I said, I mean, you can kneel here and do it if you want to. I said, but you probably want to go home and think it through. And I looked around and he was on his knees by the desk. I wasn't really expecting that. I had to think, what on earth do I do? And I have no idea what the cleaner made of it. But he prayed a prayer rather like this man's. God, have mercy on me, a sinner. Now, that's not the end of his Christian life, but it was the start of it. And you pray like that, it won't make you self-righteous. The tax collector knew there was nothing righteous in himself. He'd not done anything to make himself acceptable. He just knew who to bring his sins to. God, have mercy on me, the sinner. Some of you say, I prayed a prayer like that years and years, decades ago in some cases. And yet there are Christian lives that began that way. And now we think how very Christian we are. And what a pillar of a Christian church we make. And we may need to pray again and remind ourselves of actually not only where it begins, but what the truth is. Not that we're wonderfully special, but that we've found a Savior who's wonderfully special. And then there'll be someone here tonight who's never faced God and prayed that prayer. God, have mercy on me, a sinner. And tonight will be a wonderful opportunity to do it. So I'm going to suggest we just have a moment of quiet. A moment just to face God in the silence of our own hearts. I can't pray it for you. I can only pray for me. God, have mercy on me, a sinner. God, have mercy on me, a sinner. If that's a prayer you have prayed tonight, look, on the way out, I'll be by the exit over there. Just let me know, because I've got a number of copies of a little booklet I'd love to give to you. It's just called Jesus, Who, Why, So, What. 5 pictures that give a basic foundation for the Christian life. I'd love to give it to you. Obviously, whether you prayed it or not, if it's something you realize you need to sort out, then that Life Explored series starting tomorrow night would be a wonderful place to do it. But as we draw to a close, we're going to sing a song again. It's a song of someone who's prayed just that. God, have mercy on me, a sinner, who's not full of himself and looking down on others, but still amazed that God could possibly make someone like him acceptable. And can it be that I should gain an interest in the Savior's blood, he asks. Let's stand and sing this great hymn together.